I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of April 15th, 2011. I hope your taxes are done. You know, banks have done a most excellent job getting around the new restrictions on the fees they charge customers. But if you're trying to figure out the new ones, good luck with that.
Right now, it's one of the few places where consumers can actually compare apples to apples in an easy way. But they're supposed to be able to.
We'll hear the findings of a new report. Plus, scholarship advice for college-bound grade schoolers?
There's the Jif peanut butter and jelly sandwich contest. It's a real contest and has a top prize of $25,000.
That must be some pretty gourmet PB&J. And workers in the Gulf of Mexico were faced with a tough decision after the oil spill.
Do I wait for a larger settlement, or do I take my sanity? And the sanity won out.
We'll find out how they're faring 1 year later. Those stories and more coming up on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
The mortgage mess has been with us for several years now. Horror story after horror story of home ownership gone terribly wrong. Borrowers certainly played their part in this drama, but so did the nation's banks. And this week they got some measure of comeuppance. In a deal with federal regulators, mortgage servicers agreed to change the foreclosure process and compensate those wrongly evicted. But for many consumers, it is not enough, Marketplace's David Gura reports.
Jacqueline Freeman and her husband live on a small farm in Washington State with cows and goats and chickens.
Hey, girls. Yeah, chick, 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 chick.
And a few years ago, money got tight. So she called her bank to ask for a loan modification. And they told her she couldn't get better terms unless she was delinquent. They said skipping two payments would do the trick.
Oh my gosh, I didn't sleep that first night because I had never been late in a mortgage payment.
After two cycles, she started making payments again. But Freeman never got the loan modification.
About a year later, we got a foreclosure notice. And I said, well, that can't be right. We've done exactly everything that the bank has requested of us.
She ended up on what's called the dual track, where mortgage modification is in a race against foreclosure. Katie Porter is a law professor at the University of Iowa.
So you can have a consumer complying, sending in paperwork, doing everything they're supposed to be doing to try to get this loan modification. But if the foreclosure proceeds more rapidly, the homeowner winds up without a loan modification.
More than half of the mortgage servicing industry, 14 companies, have signed consent orders with federal regulators promising to change their ways, to hire more staff and consultants. But Porter is skeptical.
It's very difficult to evaluate whether or not this consent order goes far enough, is powerful enough, and will actually correct the abuses.
Attorneys general from all 50 states have been pursuing a settlement for years. They want mandatory loan modifications and as much as $20 billion for borrowers. Porter says the companies were shrewd to settle with the federal bank regulators.
By settling with some of them, they weaken the leverage of the remaining regulators like the state's attorney generals.
Now, she says financial institutions have less incentive to settle with the attorneys general.
Their alternative is going to be to file lawsuits. They'd have to do that in every single state if they wanted to effect relief in every single state, and they'd have to allow the judicial process to move forward.
The consent orders call for the companies to pay borrowers who suffered financial injury as a result of wrongful foreclosure, but the sum is yet to be determined, and regulators told the firms to come up with their own plans for how to do that. Jacqueline Freeman has a message for folks in the other Washington.
You know, I think the congressmen, their ears get turned a lot by what the banking industry says they can and they can't do. And they don't really think of themselves as much as being able to police the industry as I'd like to see done.
Freeman finally got her senator involved and got her loan modified. She's just grateful she and her husband made it through. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace Money.
The Freemans are in the majority of American homeowners who don't actually own their homes. Most of us are only part owners, along with our best buddy, the bank. The number of Americans who own their homes outright has changed over the decades. In 1950, more than half were free and clear of a mortgage. Now, as Jennifer Guerra tells us, it's far less than that, but she did find some.
According to the 2010 census, one in three American homeowners is exactly that. They own their homes free and clear. With numbers like that, you'd think it'd be easy to find somebody who's mortgage-free. But when I posted a search on Facebook, I got answers like, LOL, and hope I live that long, and I'm your man in 29 years. But with a little more digging, I came across the Murphys.
Hi.
Hi.
Meet Mike and Kate Murphy. They live in a working-class neighborhood of Chicago with their kids, Becky and Tommy, and their pet fish.
Flo, Chico, and Toker.
In 1996, a week after Becky was born, the Murphys bought a charming three-bedroom brick house for $156,000.
We originally started out with a $110,000 mortgage, and it was obviously the largest mortgage we'd ever taken out.
At the time, Kate brought in $30,000 a year, designing theater costumes part-time. Mike was making $50,000 as a public school teacher. Now, at first, they paid $1,100 a month on the mortgage. Refinancing dropped the payment to just under $1,000, but they decided to pay a little more each month, at first $100 and then later $150. Before buying the house, they made a pact to pay it off early so they could get a head start on saving for their retirement. 13 years later, they own their home free and clear. To celebrate, they invited 20 of their closest friends over, grilled some steaks, popped the champagne, and burned their mortgage.
We, brought the papers out, and we really did set fire to them. It was actually a lot of fun.
We have a picture.
We have a picture. I have proof that we actually did it.
Are a lot of people that you know, a lot of your friends or your family members in the same boat? They're living mortgage-free, or are people jealous?
People are jealous. I mean, when we posted our pictures on Facebook, mortgage burning party, we got comments like, oh, so jealous, from people who I happen to know have more income than we do, but I wouldn't trade making more money for having a mortgage that's paid off.
Yeah, we have absolutely
none. No credit card debt. We own our cars. We own our home.
Yeah. I'm sure half of America listening, when they listen to it, they're going to be like,
how did they do that? So, we just don't buy things that we can't afford.
Right.
And we live a little below our means.
That phrase, living below your means, is a big one in the Murphy household. Their parents were Depression-era babies, and saving was a way of life. Kate Murphy remembers her dad's regular advice: always have an extra $20 in your wallet and never spend it.
Living below your means doesn't mean that you can't live well. It just means that you don't give in to your id all the time. The only extravagant thing that I have is part of the season ticket package to the Chicago Cubs. Seriously.
It's your Cubs ticket?
Yeah, I got to have.
Seriously?
I mean, that's the only extravagant thing that I have.
And beer. No Bud Light for this guy. He is a Guinness man all the way. Still, they did have to sacrifice to pay down that mortgage. They rarely ate out or went on expensive vacations. Kate Murphy still feels bad about not buying her kids a piano or getting them music lessons. And she and Mike put off their dream trip of going to Ireland on their 50th birthdays. But was all the sacrifice really worth it in the long run? To find out, I called Bob Van Order. He's a professor of real estate and finance at George Washington University.
Owning a house free and clear and owning a house and borrowing are actually very similar because you've got advantages either way.
On one hand, since the Murphys paid off their mortgage 2 years early, they saved about $13,000 a year in principal payments and interest. On the other hand, he said, the Murphys missed an investment opportunity. Since you can deduct mortgage interest from your federal income tax, the Murphys basically had free money from their lender that they could have put in the stock market or some other kind of investment. Conceivably, they could have made more money than they saved by paying off their mortgage early. Of course, they also could have lost on a bad investment.
So it depends on what your alternatives are. But for a lot of people, it makes sense to pay down your mortgage if you can.
Meanwhile, Mike and Kate are asking themselves these questions all over again. They want to buy some property to build a house for their retirement, and they'll need to take out another mortgage to do so. In Chicago, I'm Jennifer Guerra for Marketplace Money.
You know, you've heard that your bank is probably charging you all kinds of new fees these days, in part to make up for the ones they're no longer allowed to charge. But do you know exactly what you're paying for the privilege of banking?
Well, this week, the U.S. Public Interest Research Group reported that banks are continuing to hide many of those fees from their customers. Mitch Lipka covered the story for Reuters, and he's here with the details. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, banks aren't as forthcoming as they should be about fees. Bowl me over with a feather.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing where, you know, I don't think it's a shock that it's not that way. It's more a matter of what it ought to be, and I think that's more surprising. I think there ought to be a way that you can comparison shop to find the different fees that different banks are charging. And right now, it's one of the few places where consumers can actually compare apples to apples in an easy way. But they're supposed to be able to.
Right. And basically what this study found is not only are you not able to compare fees easily, but you can't even find the fees on the accounts that you already have.
Yeah, it's a challenge no matter how you look at it. And that's not, you know, blanket. There are some banks that do it completely above board. And it's more a matter of when you look across the entire board, it's really quite a challenge.
So what does the law say about how easy it should be for us to figure out what we're being charged to put our money in a bank?
You're supposed to be able to ask for it and get it. Just that simple. And one of the things in the survey that they found out, there was only a 4 in 10 chance that you were going to actually get it on that first request.
You know, aside from asking for transparency in these fees, the Public Interest Research Group also, you know, noted that banks are still trying to get consumers to do things like opt into overdraft protection. And it's something that they want stopped. Why is this still a problem?
Well, I think consumers completely misunderstand the idea of opt-in, opt-out. The banks did a really good job of selling to consumers the idea that, you know, you can opt into something that was somehow going to be a benefit. Opting in means you will benefit from them getting your money if you commit an overdraft. In my mind, there's no good to come of opting in.
You know, this is one of those things that has come up since all the legislation last year that had to do with consumer protections. And, you know, I think there's a sense that no matter how many consumer protections are passed, credit card reform, financial reform, banks are going to find a way around it. It really is this game of whack-a-mole, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, it's no great surprise that that's the game. It's really just a matter of how to position yourself as a consumer to try to not get caught up in that game. Banks are not the only ones that do this. I mean, whenever there's a law, there's an entire team of people whose job is to do nothing but find the loopholes in the law. You just need to watch out for yourself. And in this particular case, with banks and credit card companies, you need to look at your statements and see, is there any new surprises there? If you don't like what's going on and how you're treated, take your business someplace else.
Do a little homework.
Exactly.
Mitch Lipka is a consumer columnist for Reuters. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Next week marks 1 year since the BP oil spill. Fishermen in the region are still struggling with what to do next.
You know, just because of an oil spill, I don't feel like I should want to have to change careers now, you know? And if I did, I would think that they should be responsible for that.
That's next on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland, and it is time once again for your questions. Helping us out this week is our own economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hey, Chris.
Hey, how you doing, Tess?
I'm well. And how are you doing? Have you finished your taxes yet?
Yes, I have. Well, I didn't actually do them. I had an accountant do them.
Uh-huh.
So I guess I went through the gathering the information.
No DIY taxes for you.
But I still have to do a fair amount of, you know, gathering information together so they'd be done. So anyway, I did. How about you? What do you do?
I do it really early on. I do it as soon as all my paperwork comes in because I get a refund.
Oh, okay.
So I want that right quick. Now, are you going to scold me about that? Are you going to scold me about getting a refund?
No, here's my feeling about a refund. I wish I got a refund. I know if I'm wearing my personal finance hat, I shouldn't say that.
I know, exactly.
But the fact of the matter is, it's nice to get that refund, not to have to write a check. So no, I think it's fine. Feel good about it.
All right, well, let's head to the phones. And Stephen is on the line. He's with us from White Plains, New York. Hi, Stephen.
Hi.
And are you enjoying this weekend tax-free or not?
No, unfortunately not. I'm going to be grinding it out like everybody else.
Oh, my. So why do you save it till the last minute?
I guess nobody likes pain.
Right. So you want to put that off as long as possible. So what do you do there in New York?
Well, I'm actually a teacher in the New York City public school system. I do a lot of data work in my school, and I also teach math.
So do you teach personal finance as well?
I try to get students interested in finance. There is a small group of students that we talk to about the S&P 500.
Cool.
And what it is about the risks of investing in the stock market or bonds versus maybe just putting money in a savings account.
Fantastic. Is this something that you've done your whole career?
Well, no. Actually, I worked in banking and finance for about 25 years. This is a third career for me. I had the opportunity of working for UBS and Deutsche Bank for a while.
Oh, interesting.
So I learned a lot there.
So is this a second act for you, as they call it?
This is a second act for me.
Excellent.
It's very rewarding.
So you were actually willing to give up a teacher's salary to work in banking?
Well, at the time that happened, I was making $9,000 in teaching. So, yes.
So what's your question for us today? How can we help out the math teacher?
Well, my question is, I have a daughter that's 18. I'm going to be turning 60. And I am legally bound through a divorce contract to finance half of her college education. So the question is, I'd want to support my daughter anyway, but right. I'm not really sure how to finance this, since the common wisdom is saying do not take money out of your IRA accounts or any 401ks that you might have.
Right.
So the big question is, what do I do?
What kind of savings do you have set aside, if any?
I have two 401ks with about 18 grand in them each.
And what about aside from your retirement plans?
Nothing.
Okay, and you hadn't started at like a 529 plan or anything like that?
No.
Do you get a state pension?
I do have money in my pension, but however, that's like I'm in this tier four, which means I'm doing all the contributing for it.
Right.
Chris, this is a tough one because, you know, in general, our mantra is pay yourself first before anything.
Right.
You don't touch your retirement funds unless you absolutely have to, but this does not sound like it's an option.
No, well, I have a couple of thoughts. I mean, one is, I hope you enjoy your work, because I think you're going to continue to be working.
I thought about that.
That's, you know, that's a, that, because a chunk of that cash flow is going to be going to help pay for college.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that I don't know what the levels of trust are, but one of the approaches that I really like is that, you know, you pay some of the money out of your cash flow, and then you would have your daughter borrow the money. And the interest rate is 6.8%. And the thing is, you can then pay off the loan. There's nothing wrong. It's perfectly straightforward. There's nothing underhanded here. But she can borrow at a lower rate, take maximum advantage of the Stafford loans, and then you can pay it off over a period of time. That's one way of doing it. If that's not an option, then I would consider looking at a PLUS loan.
PLUS loan.
The parent version of a student loan.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The interest rate is 7.9%.
Wow. In this market?
In this market. The thing about the PLUS loan is essentially you'll be approved. And then it's a 10-year repayment plan. And there's a wonderful website, finaid.org.
Mm-hmm.
It's full of great information. So before I did anything, I'd be running the numbers. I would still have her borrow more. And then you would pay off that debt over a period of time.
Yeah. Well, I thank you both very much. Tess, I love listening to your show. And I wish you continued success.
Well, thank you so much for the call. Appreciate it. And good luck. Bye-bye. All right. Christina is with us, and she is in Chi-Town, Chicago, Illinois. Hi, Christina.
Hi, Tess and Chris. Thanks so much for taking my question.
Oh, it is our pleasure. Are you thawing out there?
Slowly but surely. Yesterday, I had my windows open for the first time in 6 months.
Very nice. So what do you do there in Chicago?
I am an attorney. I do civil rights defense, specializing in representing police officers or public officials.
Wow. Now, that's quite a specialty. How'd you get into that?
I guess you could say it was kind of a fluke. I had done a bit of criminal work in another state in Louisiana, and after the storms down there, I decided not to stick it out in case it should ever happen again, and so I took the Illinois bar and moved up here and just happened across this job, and it's been wonderful.
Wow. So you were in Louisiana during Katrina?
I was in Louisiana during Katrina, yes. I was actually impacted by Hurricane Rita, the second storm to hit the state.
What happened to you?
Significant damage to my house. I had just closed on a house within a month of the storm.
Oh, geez.
And so we had, you know, quite a bit of damage to the house that had to be fixed before it could go on the market.
It's hard to believe that was, more than 5 years ago at this point.
Blows my mind how much has happened since then.
Well, so tell us what's happened since then and how we can help you out with whatever you're calling for.
So since then, I took the Illinois bar and moved to Chicago, found this great job, met the man of my dreams.
Congratulations.
And we are getting married in 2 months.
Oh, wonderful.
Okay.
Yes. Thanks. And so now I've kind of started my adult life, and I've kind of been wondering what to do. You know, I hadn't, obviously, through my 20s, I hadn't really put away any money for retirement. But I've tried to be responsible after, especially with what happened in Louisiana. I really made sure to keep my credit in check, and we've been careful to try and put aside enough money in the emergency fund. They tell us to save for, you know, approximately 6 months of our expenses, and so now I'm looking at my retirement, and I don't even know what to do. I know that everyone tells me you're in your early 30s and you better not count on Social Security. So I'm putting aside about 11% of my income, and my employer gives me 3%, but I just don't know what to do with it.
You don't know what to do with the money that you're setting aside?
Correct.
So you don't know, you want to know about asset allocation then?
Exactly.
Aha. Uh-huh. First of all, Chris, I think we have to give her a pat on the back because, I mean, 11% is great. Add on another 3 from her employer, and she's very close to 20, which is amazing.
And no credit card debt and an emergency fund. So I think you're doing really well. Might want to toss in one idea in there and see what you think of this test would be considering opening up a Roth IRA at some point. You don't get any upfront tax break. But the big thing is when you withdraw the money in retirement, all the gain, all the earnings is tax-free.
Oh, okay.
So is most of the retirement money right now in that work-related 401k?
It is. They gave us, you know, a sort of money manager, I guess. Based on my conversation with her, I just put it in this general account in the most aggressive category they had, and I'm just letting it ride.
Okay, so Chris, that's a kind of part two of this question, which is the money that she has set aside, what's the best thing for her to do with it? Should all of it be in, it sounds like it's all in stocks, right, Christina?
Yeah, I think if there's a portion that's not, it's less than 5%.
Wow.
And then it may not only just be in stocks because some of the aggressive portfolios that are out there might have some junk bonds, might have some international securities. So at this point, I'm extremely wary of the most aggressive funds in general, mainly because of what are they made up of. And I would lean toward the conservative end of the spectrum in terms of everything being blue chip stocks, blue chip bonds. These are, you know, think General Electric. Think IBM.
Right. I guess my concern was just I had missed both the principal savings through my 20s and then the compounding interest. So I feel kind of behind the ball not starting until I'm in my 30s. And I guess I thought maybe that would be a quick way to make it up. But you can't get something for nothing, can you?
Chris, I think a lot of people are doing that right now. Not just people who didn't save in their 20s and are now trying to catch up, but, you know, people who lost money in the downturn and now are taking all kinds of risk to try to make up for that. Is that wise?
No, that's just not a good way to invest your retirement, to try and make up the time. Because the problem is the market doesn't care that you're trying to make up time.
It doesn't care how old you are.
It doesn't care how old you are. The risks are embedded. What that means is the downside is also larger.
Okay. Thank you guys so much.
You're most welcome. Best of luck with the wedding and congratulations in advance.
Oh, thank you so much. Y'all have a great afternoon.
And finally, we go to David, and he is in Piqua, Ohio. Hi, David.
Hey, Tess. Hey, Chris.
Your voice is familiar. We've talked to you before.
So this is my third time, and I'm starting to feel like I should have my own segment on the show.
Well, we'll talk about that offline. But, you know, when we last caught up with you, you were not living in Ohio. You were in Birmingham, Alabama, and on the verge of a very big decision. Let's take a listen.
All Mom and Dad ever wanted us to be was happy and educated and to love what we do. And I don't love what I do. But all I hear is, you know, if you have a job, you'd be insane to quit it.
Now, we'll remind folks that this was in 2009. So I think, Chris, that we were advising that was not a good time to be quitting your job. So, David, tell us what you did.
Instead of quitting my job in 2009, I quit it in 2010.
Okay.
Chris said, take it one step at a time, maybe go down to part-time. Of course, as usual, I didn't listen to him. I had a particularly bad week at work, and I said, you know, this isn't me. I had found a tiny little farm up here in Ohio. Horrible shape. The house is 100 years old.
Oh, my goodness.
Needs a lot of work. So like any thinking marketplace money listener, I just went ahead and bought it.
listeners, he's being facetious.
And we moved up here October 17th, and every day since has been more meaningful to me.
Oh, wow.
than the 10 years combined. But what I really wanted to say was, I know that sometimes marketplace money is just this first-rate show about money and finance. But you know what? It's so much more than that. It's people, whether it's folks on the air or staff or producers, that are extremely knowledgeable and kind and decent. And every once in a while, in my case, you happen to change a life. And I want to thank you so much for that.
Well, thank you so much, David. And, you know, I think this also shows that, you know, Chris, whatever advice is given out on this show, you know, you can take little pieces of it or none of it at all. But hopefully in some way, shape or form, it helps you out. Thanks so much for the call.
Tess, Chris, thank you guys so much. And I guess I'll talk to you in about a year.
Okay, we'll expect your call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye, you guys. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. If you've got a financial question, tell us all about it at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or you can write to us through the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. Chris, thanks as always for the great advice.
Tess, it was fun. Thank you.
And do remember to check with your own financial professional before you make any big money decisions. This week marks 1 year since the Deepwater Horizon oil rig exploded in the Gulf of Mexico. It killed 11 workers. And over the next several months, it leaked millions of barrels of oil into the Gulf. Under an agreement with the U.S. government, BP set up a $20 billion compensation fund for coastal residents whose livelihoods were endangered by the spill. Anyone who accepted a settlement offer gave up the right to sue. Marketplace's Eve Tro recently returned to the Gulf to explore how some locals wrestled with that decision.
Driving down to Venice, Louisiana, you can't miss the billboards and signs. Oil spill claim too low? Call us. The closer you get to the Gulf, the more there are. I'm here to meet fishing tour guide Susan Groh. She runs
Real Louisiana Adventures.
Her business dried up after the spill. I ask if she called that billboard number. No, she says. Didn't even think about it. She says she'll tell me her spill story later. Right now, she wants to fish. We head out on a 22-foot skeeter with boat captain Buddy Bergeron.
Our strategy is we're going to get right up on this point. We're going to cast over.
We cast out and hit a run of huge redfish.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
boy. That's the sound I like to hear.
I set down the microphone to help. Our catch is barely in the ice chest.
We're in the box.
When Susan gets another one.
Today we're going to make up for lost time.
This is her first fishing trip in a year. Before the oil spill, she was on the water 3 times a week. But after,
the phone stopped ringing.
Now she's landlocked most days at a retail job.
In a very large store in the garden center.
When BP began the first round of final payouts, she said to herself,
do I wait for a larger settlement or do I take my sanity? And the sanity won out.
She took $25,000.
I wanted to move on with my life.
BP has based all settlements on science that says the Gulf will be back to normal in another year. Susan Groh isn't sure of that. Few people down here are. But she took the check and gave up her right to sue for more.
And I'm going to cut it again.
Our boat captain, Buddy Bergeron, cleans the catch with an electric knife.
Look at that fillet, how pretty.
After the spill, he did what a lot of boat captains here did. He went to work for BP. They needed locals like him who know the serpentine coastline. He hunted for oil slicks and ferried officials up until last month. Now he's back to fishing, but bookings are down. Bergeron's still deciding whether to take a BP settlement. He says the oil still in the water or dispersant used to break it up could hurt things down the line and sink his career.
You know, just because of a oil spill, I don't feel like I should want to have to change careers now, you know? And if I did, I would think that they should be responsible for that, you know?
About 150 miles east in Biloxi, Mississippi, shrimp boats pack the harbor. Veteran boat captain Rodney Willis walks the docks, nervous about the new season.
And you'll see baby shrimp swimming around the pilings, and I haven't seen any of that this winter.
seafood is testing fine now. But in Alaska, the herring catch collapsed 4 years after the Valdez spill.
Well, that was one-tenth of what we had in the Gulf as far as oil.
Willis used to be captain on a boat that caught small silver fish, the kind in fish oil capsules.
Oh, yes, I take them myself. Keep cholesterol down.
But his anxiety is up. After the spill, Willis's company took his boat off the water and put him in a much lower-paying job. Willis asked BP to make up the wage gap, sent tax returns to back it up. BP's final offer is $5,000 total.
I know people that's in my same position that's gotten twice as much as me, even three and four times more than I have.
Very recognizable. I'm very concerned.
John Joplin scans the claim. He's a lawyer at the nonprofit Mississippi Center for Justice, a legal aid group.
Given the uncertainty about the type of living a fisherman could make in the Gulf of Mexico over the next several years, it's hard to imagine that $5,000 is adequate compensation.
It's hard to imagine what would be adequate, says Rodney Willis, given all the conflicting science and opinions.
You know, you make a final claim, you're just taking a shot in the dark, really.
But lawsuits are a shot in the dark, too, and they could take decades. Willis says for most people along the Gulf, the decision to settle with BP is based on necessity, not what they believe. I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace Money.
And you can read more about Eve's fishing trip at our blog, Making Money. It's at marketplace.org/money. Paying for college can be a nightmare, but sometimes it can also be the mother of invention.
I'm a first-generation college attendee, so my parents really had no idea where to help me start. So it really motivated me to think of a new digital tool to find financial aid.
Stay tuned for more Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. The college class of 2015 has pretty much decided at this point which campus they'll be moving to in the fall. Now they're trying to figure out how to pay for it. Sure, there are plenty of websites and books to help answer that question, but another somewhat unorthodox source jumped into the fray this year, MTV. The music channel, along with the College Board, sponsored a contest designed to simplify the financial aid process. Joining us to talk about that contest is Jason Rzebka, a vice president at MTV. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Tess.
Tell us a little bit about this challenge. What were you hoping to get out of it?
Certainly. So the challenge that we ran was part of a bigger campaign run by Viacom and the Gates Foundation called Get Schooled. And this is a five-year campaign to increase high school completion rates, increase college preparedness, and increase college completion rates. We at MTV have been really focused on the issue of college affordability.
Yeah, hard to complete college if you can't afford it.
Absolutely. So we went out to our audience nationwide, current and aspiring college students, and said, give us a great idea for a digital tool that'll make it easier to find money for college.
And for all their efforts, what does the winner get?
So the winner of our college affordability challenge is going to get a $10,000 prize, and they're also going to see their idea brought to life by a $100,000 development budget and launched with the full backing and weight of MTV and the College Board. And
wow.
Our hope is that we'll be ready to introduce it no later than late fall or in early winter.
That is one nice prize. All right, well, let's talk with the winner, Devin Valencia. Is 22 years old, a recent graduate of UNLV in Las Vegas. Hi, Devin.
Hi.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
What was your reaction when you first heard about this contest? Obviously, you must agree that financing college is a big issue for your peers.
Yeah, I'm a first-generation college attendee, so my parents really had no idea where to help me start, and I myself had no idea where to start. So I kind of had to do everything on my own. So it really motivated me to think of a new digital tool accessible to all students that don't have the access of, you know, knowing where to start to find financial aid.
Well, tell us about your winning project. What does it do? What is it?
It's called Connect Fund, and
basically what it is a Facebook application.
Hmm.
And it helps students connect to grants and loans. And it also connects students with scholarships based on their demographic information that's provided through Facebook. So, for example, say I'm into hiking. It will match me specifically with scholarships that has to do with hiking.
Hmm.
And it also has a discussion board where students can chat with each other about financial aid.
Jason, what do you think it was about this particular idea from Devin that your voters responded to?
Well, I think that, one, it's a really elegant solution. So if you're going to set out to find scholarships, you have to fill out page after page of information in terms of where you live and your ethnicity and your major. We've now taken all that barrier away because it's taking the data directly from a Facebook profile. And the other thing that this does is it's the first ever social tool for financial aid.
Hmm.
And we know that our audience will always turn to their friends first as a resource to support each other.
Boy, you know, it's with all of the applications and other help that you can find on Facebook, I am astonished that something like this wasn't already out there. I guess, Devin, you were really filling a niche that needed to be filled.
Yeah, there's no educational, you know, outlet out there on a social media network. So I thought, why not combine the both since students are already there?
Yeah, absolutely. So what are you going to do with this $10,000?
I actually have a student loan that I need to pay off. So I think I'm probably going to use some of the money towards that.
That's not very exciting, is it?
No, it's exciting because I won't have that weight of having to pay that off.
Absolutely. What are you planning to do? What do you want to do with your degree?
Well, I graduated with my bachelor's in psychology,
mm-hmm.
and I want to get my master's in psychology,
okay.
and hopefully have my own practice one day or something with social helping.
Social helping and social media, maybe?
Yes.
Fantastic. Well, Devin Valencia, best of luck to you and congratulations.
Thank you so much.
And Jason Rzepka, thanks so much for talking with us and congrats on finishing the challenge.
Thanks so much for having us.
Mark Kantrowitz has written a new book about how to pay for college. He's well known in financial aid circles for his all-encompassing website, finaid.org, which we mentioned earlier in the show. The new book is called Secrets to Winning a Scholarship. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
All parents who are trying to pay for the kids' education are really looking for the magic bullet, how to pay as little as possible, get them as much help as possible. Of course, the free ride is the pinnacle of that, but you say that whole idea is a myth. How so?
Less than 0.3% of students win enough money to pay for their entire tuition. So the idea that you can get a completely free ride through scholarships is pretty rare. Many families will have to rely on money from the federal and state government and from the colleges themselves.
If the free ride is a myth, how much of a student's education should parents realistically expect to be covered by scholarships?
A lot depends on the talent of the student. The more talented you are, the more money you'll win.
Sure.
If we were to average it across all students, we're looking at maybe 5% of money to pay for college is coming from the private sector scholarships.
5%? That sounds really low.
But every dollar you win in a scholarship is a dollar less you have to borrow, so it can help reduce your out-of-pocket costs.
Yeah. Well, in the book, it's quite clear that a lot of parents miss out on scholarship money because of some pretty basic things. What are the biggest mistakes that parents are making when it comes to applying for those?
First of all, families often wait until the spring of the senior year in high school to start trying to figure out how to pay for college. And just for the scholarships for high school seniors, they've missed half the deadlines. Half the deadlines are in the fall, and half the deadlines are in the spring. And there are scholarships that you can win in the 9th, 10th, 11th grade in high school. There are even scholarships you can win in grades kindergarten through 8th grade. For example, there's the Jif Peanut Butter and Jelly Sandwich Contest. It's a real contest, and it has a top prize of $25,000.
Sounds delicious.
Yeah.
You also tackle some of the myths around minority students and low-income students winning the majority of the scholarships. Is that true? And if not, does that mean that kind of everybody has pretty much the same chance of winning one?
72% of scholarship recipients are Caucasian, even though they represent only 62% of the college student population.
Hmm.
The only race that has a higher odds of winning a scholarship than Caucasian students are American Indian and Alaskan Natives.
There are always questions surrounding what these scholarships then do to your potential for getting financial aid. What is some advice that you have around negotiating that aspect of paying for college?
First of all, every college has what's called an outside scholarship policy. If you're receiving need-based aid and then you win a scholarship, that reduces your eligibility for need-based aid because it's reducing your financial need. Mm-hmm. The colleges have some flexibility, however, in how they reduce your need-based financial aid package.
So that's a real key question to ask the financial office.
Right. Ask the college financial aid administrator, what is your outside scholarship policy? And then you can potentially use that to negotiate, not eliminate the reduction in the aid package because they really don't have any choice in that matter, but how they reduce it.
You also talk in the book about all the scholarship scams that are out there. What should parents be aware of, and how common are they really?
If you have to pay money to get money, it's probably a scam because scholarship providers are about giving away money. They'll have some plausible sounding method of getting the money from you. They might say it's the taxes or that it's an application fee, and it may be an innocuous amount, say $3. But even if they give away every dollar that they say they do, they're getting more revenue from these fees than they're paying out in scholarships.
Any other final tips for students going through this right now?
One of the best tips in the book is to answer all of the optional questions on scholarship matching profiles.
Hmm.
A lot of students answer only the required questions, but the optional questions are there to trigger the inclusion of awards. So students who answer the optional questions are going to match about twice as many scholarships as students who answer just the required questions.
Wow, that is a good one. Mark Katrowitz is the author of a new book called Secrets to Winning a Scholarship. He's also the founder of FinAid.org. Mark, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And for more on financial aid, go to our Making Money blog at marketplace.org. We've got a post about getting rid of the FAFSA from the authors of Why Does College Cost So Much? Many families across the country had to make a tough decision this college acceptance season. They had to tell their kids that they just couldn't afford their first choice school, maybe not even their second choice. Commentator Jen Miller has some advice for dealing with that dilemma.
Pick the cheap school. I had my heart set on Boston University. I was going to study marine biology, then move to Australia to study the coral of the Great Barrier Reef. I saw this as my only path to success and happiness. That same year, my parents were divorcing. There was no money for BU unless the school offered scholarships and grants. And they didn't. The University of Tampa, however, did. My parents told me I had no choice. I was Florida bound. I was incensed with all the rage a 17-year-old can muster. My parents hated me. The world hated me. I was doomed. I'd never be a successful coral-studying, Australian-living marine biologist because my parents decided to get divorced instead of letting me go to my dream school. Did I mention I was 17? Well, guess what? The world didn't collapse. The sky did not fall. My life, of course, was not ruined. I picked another major and graduated with a budding writing career. Plus, I had no guillotine of massive student loans hovering over my neck. So I could take a risk. I pursued a career as a freelance journalist and author. Yes, it was my passion, but it's so much easier to follow your passion when you don't have the equivalent of a mortgage payment for a monthly student loan. My parents forcing me to go to the cheaper school was the best thing they could have done. Today, I still see so many of my peers in their 30s struggle to get out from under the financial obligations of expensive old degrees. If there's no way you can afford $50,000 a year in tuition and fees without jeopardizing your retirement or setting your child up for a life of repayment, there is only one thing you need to know. Pick the cheaper school. Even if it means your 17-year-old rants and screams that his or her life is over. I promise you they'll thank you for it. Eventually.
Jen Miller is a freelance journalist in Philadelphia. You can find her on Twitter at Jersey Shore Jen. While you're at it, follow me at Radio Tess. Aside from owning a home, chances are your second biggest financial black hole is your car. So in a couple of weeks, we are going on the road for the full hour to explore all the ways we dump money into car ownership, buying them, fixing them, and for some folks, drooling all over them.
The cars are not an appliance. They're such an extension of yourself and your personality and what you stand for. And it could be a sports car because you like speed. It could be a hybrid because you want to be green. It could be an SUV because you say, look at me, I'm a big outdoorsy kind of person. This country is all about cars, for better and for worse. I will notice a beautiful car, you know, 10 times more than I might necessarily notice a pretty way. And there's lots of pretty women in L.A., trust me.
Oh, thank you. We want to know what you think your car says about you. So head on over to marketplace.org/money to share a photo and a story about your wheels, past or present. You can also see classic photos of some Marketplace peeps with their memorable cars. And tune in the weekend of April 29th as we take money on the road. And finally, this hour, the other day something arrived in our inbox from a listener that made us so proud we decided to call up to hear the story. Mohammed Noor and his 11-year-old daughter Megan are in Durham, North Carolina, and they join us now from their home. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks.
Mohammed, let me start with you. You wrote us an email and told us that you wanted to share a recent success story. Tell us what that story was.
Well, Megan's always been pretty good about how much money she asks us to spend on things for her. But starting when she was about 6, she got tired of the standard kids' meals when we go out to eat. And she'd always prefer what we were ordering over the standard corn dogs and chicken nuggets and things like that. So listening to your show, we actually heard a mother and daughter talking about something similar in terms of clothes. So Megan and I made a kind of similar deal. What I agreed to do was to raise her allowance to cover moderate meals for our weekly outings, and we have that amount automatically transferred to her prepaid MasterCard every week. And the deal is any money that she doesn't spend is hers to keep. So we started the experiment a little bit over a month ago, and personally, I think it's gone great so far. Megan's definitely moderating what she orders and has more money to do things that she wants to do. And I'm spending less, and there's definitely less stress because I'm not telling her what to order, or more importantly, what not to order. But finally, I think it's a good life experience for her when she's still fairly young. She's only 11 at this point.
Megan, what do you think of all this?
I really like it. I like having more money to spend on jewelry and stuff like that.
Now, how do you end up having more money to spend when you are ordering higher-priced items off the menu these days?
I order cheaper items now. Like, if I was at a Mexican restaurant before, I would have ordered fajitas or something like that. Uh-huh. But now I'm more likely to order a quesadilla or something cheaper like that.
What are you hoping that she gets out of this, Mohammed?
Probably I was hoping just for a good life experience because, you know, she's going to be going to college before we know it. And, you know, being able to moderate, thinking that, well, I have this budget, this is how much money I can use for it. But I have to admit, secondarily, it would be saving money for us in the short term.
Well, I have some very exciting news for both of you.
Oh, yeah?
Because of this email and because of how you have managed to come up with this great way of teaching your daughter money, you are the inaugural winners of the Marketplace Money Piggy Bank Contest.
Oh, my goodness.
It's mine.
You will be getting a beautiful, bright blue plastic piggy bank. Let me see. I put just a few quarters in this one. And each week we are deciding if a listener or someone on the show or perhaps a Facebook fan is pig worthy or perhaps pig needy. You are in the pig worthy camp.
Excellent. Thank you. We're honored.
Thanks.
So, how do you get a prized Marketplace Money piggy bank? Well, as I mentioned, you may be a caller or a listener, a Facebook or Twitter friend, maybe somebody we interviewed for a story, and we decide you've done something really cool and or smart with your money. Or perhaps you are in need of a helping hand to get to your savings goals. Here's one way to win. A couple of months ago, I picked a random number between 1,000 and 2,000 and wrote it on my office wall. When we hit that number on Facebook, that fan gets a piggy. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Be sure to friend us and follow me on Twitter at Radio Tess. Next time, if you're going to suck up to the boss, make sure you know what you're doing.
If you do it in a very aggressive way, in a way that would be very obvious, it's actually going to backfire.
Duh. Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Devin Robbins, Stephen Hoffman, and Sonata Lee Narsis. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM, American Public Media.